Our speaker, it's really a privilege for me to introduce the speaker. He's been an inspiration to me any time I've heard him speak. And if this is your first time, I'm sure you'll find the same experience. If it's not your first time, I'm sure you'll be inspired. So, Juno.
Thank you. I'm Jimmy Pavis over alcohol. I'm exceedingly grateful to be here this evening, and I'm grateful for all of you that are here. And gratitude is such an important element of my sobriety. I know if I'm not grateful for what I've got, I don't deserve anything more. Did you ever give that any thought? If I'm not grateful for what I have, I don't deserve anything more. If I'm not grateful for anything I have, anything that's good for me, I probably will not receive. But I think gratitude is a launching pad for success in this program because no matter, we all come in here a little different. I mean, some people come in on the surface. I know I went to my first meetings and I saw a fellow come in. You know, he said he had lost his position, which meant his job. Then he kept drinking. He lost his home. He kept drinking. His wife and children left, and he still kept drinking. And I knew another fellow came in, he had a three-piece suit on, and he sat next to me. I was only in about 3 weeks, and I looked over to him, and he had I don't know if it was a Rolex or what, you know, and he looked well-to-do, and he told me it was his first meeting, and I said, geez, you can't have hurt too much, and he says, why? I said, you still got your watch, you know? I mean, the hot shots and everything else, as I thought, what everyone would go through before they got to these rooms. But I know today, anyone in this room that identifies with the same type of alcoholism I have, which is being powerless over alcohol, came in here to these rooms with the same feelings inside that I have. That's one of the specific reasons this program works. We all know how that newcomer feels. We all know how everyone feels in these rooms. It's the inner that brings us to here. Not so much what we lost material-wise. Because some people, like I identified, are still out there losing and losing and losing. But you know, I say this too, that nothing comes from a bad thought. Nothing good comes from a bad thought. If it did, there wouldn't be anything wrong in thinking bad. Only good can come from a good thought. And yet I've heard so many say, well, you know, I had to hit my bottom to get here. I had to lose this and that to get here. I say this because I don't identify with myself, and please believe me, tonight I'm only speaking in reference to myself about my alcoholism, my God, and how my program works for me. For me, I hurt as bad as anyone else out there emotionally, internally, but it was a good thought that brought me here. I finally decided I had enough. I said, Jimmy, you owe yourself a better life than this, and I came here because of that. And that's why I see so many come in the beginning, and whether they're sent by the courts, or sent by their wives, or sent by their jobs, or just come here without the real desire, because they haven't said, it's time to change. Because when I say it's time to change, when I say that I want a new and better life, when I finally surrender to the other, that's when it will get better for me. But you know, that headache and heartache and hangover of alcoholism, that lonely days and lonely nights, the wasted days and wasted nights, that kept me out there for some reason. I don't know why. You know, if I didn't show up at that bar every day, they might mark me absent. I had to be there. I had to be there. So it wasn't until I got that good thought, Jimmy, do something. This ain't working, man. And I came here, and I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for so many in this room. And you know, it's not a thing in AA to symbolize or single out anyone. But you know, just tonight, for some reason, I have such a warm feeling for Lynn over there in the corner, Lynn B. He's just a great fellow, and what he does in this program that people don't even know. I'm just so appreciative, you know, and there's so many others in these rooms I know the same way. But I just felt the urge to mention Lynn's name tonight, and so I did, you know. And of course, many of you know I travel with Walt over there, Manny Shevitz. Most of you know him as Manny Shevitz, and they wonder, Jimmy, how do you stay serene with this guy? And I said, I don't know, as I get along in my talk, I'm going to explain how God does not test us. Like I felt at one time, and probably so many in these rooms feel that God puts these tests to us. And I said, God doesn't test me. But if he did, it would be through him. I knew him for many, many, many years ago, even when he was drinking up in New York State. That's where I'm originally from. And I remember a woman, he was out there once, and she says, Jimmy, she says, there's something suspicious about him. And I says, what's that? She says, well, I know he's a thief and a pickpocket, she said, but what does he do with all his money? And I said, well, he's a very, very benevolent fellow. She says, what do you mean? I said, he gives it to charity. She says, charity? She says, you mean like the Salvation Army or Boys Town? And I says, no, charity, that cute little brand over there on Third Ave. But he gets up here and he talks about me too, so that's the way it is. You know, we gotta, if, I always say when I go to a meeting, if there's just one person or two people, I mean, that's great. The more the merrier, but we got a nice little room full here tonight. And I don't know who everyone is. I know a lot of the faces and a lot of people know who I am. And if there's anyone here that's just coming in, you know, to maybe see if they think they might have a problem with alcohol, maybe you can identify with something I have, and I commend you for that. And if there's someone here that has a friend or a loved one and maybe you'd like to learn a little bit about this program, I commend you for that. Sometimes there's Al-Anon in here, and I know how grateful you are that we finally found this program. And if there's anyone from the clergy, you know, sometimes they attend, because this would be good, because the clergy can learn about our sickness and not our sin. And if there's anyone here from the medical profession, I don't know. But sometimes, you know, we know in Bill's story and whatever, and in the very beginning, how they tried to cure alcoholism or at least treat it medically, and it was so unsuccessful. But we found the answer, the medical answer, and please believe me, it's a continuous double dose of vitamin AA that works for me. I don't know about the rest of you. And I see a few youthful faces. I don't know how young anyone is in this room. But if you think for 1 minute that alcohol can't do a number on you, take a good close look at me. I'm only 18 years old. It'll devastate you. I hear Bob laughing because he's 21. I love to talk about my recovery, my sobriety, and I have a feeling many times when I do that it's really not me talking. You know, it's a great revelation and a great a source of gratitude when I realize that I finally opened myself up to where my God can speak through me to you people. And I think every time someone speaks at these meetings, it's so important that I listen very close, because this is my God speaking to me through someone else. God is my source for everything. Everything that I need in life. Everything that I need. We know he's the source of air. And you know, we talk about how God, blame God for certain things, and yet God gives us the air to breathe. And now the garages and gas stations are charging us for it. And you know, God gives us water to drink, and the city charges us for it. And man screws up everything and blames it on God. But the source of all good is from my God. And all good is all that I really need. There's so much truth to that phrase, that what we need in life is free. All the things we need are free. They're from God. They're free. We just have to learn how to reach out and accept them, how to receive. It isn't so much in the giving, it's in the learning how to receive. And that's what's important. I think that's why the Big Book mentions sometimes about sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. You know, our ability to receive. I know I can receive quicker in some areas of my sobriety than I can others. And we often wonder how come this person hasn't been around that long and yet they seem so far advanced in certain areas. They've learned to receive in that area. And that's what's important, is learning how to receive. I can hear, be in a room full of people and have one speaker, or even an instructor in some course, and some people will really affect that very well, and others won't. Others will receive it better, or some just won't accept it or believe it. So when someone speaks to me, when I come to these rooms and I hear someone speaking, I know God is speaking through that person. I want to hear that person. I want to understand what they're saying so I can best receive. Because I know myself, from being in many, 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 many AA meetings. I know right now in this very room that there are some who are here harboring low self-esteem, paralyzed and even crippled from the distraught emotions that identify the lower self, the alcoholic self. Doubt, worry, anger, resentment, pity, hostility, constant complaining, self-imposed limitations, brought upon by excessive drinking and the mandated wasteful life that alcoholism guarantees. The mandated wasteful life that alcoholism guarantees. I say guarantee because guarantee is a sure thing. We find that out from those who, God bless them, go back out there and come back in again. It's a guarantee, my friends. It's a guarantee. So, it is so important to understand, I believe, to listen in these rooms and practice what I hear in these rooms so that I can affect into my life peace, harmony, inner joy, abundance, and love, that which best describes the upper self or the sober alcoholic, the sober mind. When I came in these rooms, when I first came to AA, I was a walking time bomb of negative emotions. I was angry, resentful, pitiful, guilty, everything at once. I put down the drink a day at a time like they suggested and still didn't feel any better. I was still a walking time bomb of negative emotions and couldn't understand why. But I listened. I don't know why. I started listening and listening and listening. And I heard two words. Two words that identify how to start sobriety and how to stay in sobriety. Two words. Spiritual progress. Spiritual progress. There's nothing else that identifies to anything that I have to do. I don't have to run 5 miles a day. Might make me feel better. I don't have to chop 2 quarts of wood a day to stay sober. Might make me feel better. I don't have to wash dishes every day to make me feel sober. All I have to do is start growing spiritually. After I put down the drink a day at a time. And that's what's important. You know, I remember hearing about these two fellows that they just love peace and fresh air and no congestion, and they had this built this cabin up in this mountain, and they had 2 rocking chairs on their front porch, and they could look out over this chasm, as they would call it, to the other side of the mountain over there. And you know, one day some city folk were coming up there and they spotted this big bed of water, and it was like pure water. You could drink this water and it was healthy water. And so the people started coming up there and sampling this water, next thing you know, they carved a road in the side of that little mountain, and then they set up a little motel, and then there was Burger King's, and there was McDonald's, and so they're sitting on the porch, and the season, as they started to call it now, began. And they could see them coming around the mountainside, and they had their pickup trucks, and the station wagons, and the trailers, and the campers, and the bedrolls, and the pots, and the pans, and the cars steaming, and the flat tires, and the kids hollering, and the mothers hollering at the children, and the wives hollering at the husbands, and vice versa. And one looked at the other, and he says, "Well, here they come, trying to get away from it all by bringing it all with them." How many times I heard and said myself that I was sick and tired of being sick and tired of that alcoholism. Like I mentioned, that knocked down, dragged out, distraught way of living. You know, those lonely days and lonely nights, those wasted days and wasted nights. I'm sick and tired of it. And I come into these rooms and put down the drink and still walk around angry, resentful, pitiful, guilty, sour. I came in here trying to get away from it all, but I brought it all with me. And now I had to learn how to let it go, how to release it, how to surrender it, and how to take on the sober mind. The sober mind. You see, I say the sober mind. I came in here with a multitude of problems. When I came into this program, my friends, I came in here just after serving 9 years of a 40-year prison sentence in Attica State Prison. While I was in prison, my wife divorced me and took my child and moved to California. My father died, and we were very close while I was in prison. My mother cried. And I came in these rooms owing 31 and some odd change on parole. And parole in New York State is tough. What's your excuse if you go back up? I didn't. I came here because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I came here because I finally realized that alcohol was really the seat or the source of my problem, and I wanted to get out from under it. But I had to find the solution, and the only solution was in spiritual progress. I found after I came in here and started listening to you people and started reading the big book and understanding those steps, I began to realize that it was the human mind that caused all my problems. This human mind caused them all. It wasn't smart enough to solve them, or it wouldn't have caused them in the first place. Someone says, well, that's the only mind you got, Jimmy. What are you going to do? It isn't the only mind. It was the only mind I had at that time. But see, I had to take on a new mind, a different mind, and that's where change comes in. I had to take on what we call the spiritual mind and get a spiritual attitude on life and begin to understand that in the spiritual realm of living, it's like a separate room from anger, resentment, pity, guilt, frustration, worry. It's like in a separate room. It is not in that room. You see, as I grew spiritual, I began to understand that I remember one time when I went out and I had a flat tire and it was raining and I wasn't upset. I mean, it was an inconvenience, but I did not have to force a good attitude. You see, that's a mandated ingredient of spiritual growth that you understand. And you change the tire, and you drive down the road. I remember once before I had a flat tire, when I was of that other mind, that human alcoholic mind, I remember kicking that tire, no air come in it. Then I had to change the sucker, jack it up, and change it, and this and that, and jump in the car and drive off. I forgot the jack in my anger. Turn around, go back, I go for the jack and some other guy's reaching for it. This is what anger does. Ever try and justify it. Don't ever try and justify it. No way. I'm just speaking for myself. No one has to accept anything I say or believe it will work in your life. But I'm going to tell you now what gives me a powerfully successful and exotic good feeling every day. Because of this way of thinking and feeling and acting from spiritual growth and spiritual fulfillment. I remember years ago, before I come down here, I had about 14 years sobriety. And I remember outside of Syracuse, New York, I was stopped. There was a roadblock up in the afternoon. I don't know what they were looking for, but the troopers come up to the car. And don't you know, I had a driver's license, I had insurance, I had a seatbelt on. And the car was mine. And I got thinking, it was only just before I committed the program that in that same town on a rainy evening, a trooper stopped me. Not the same one, but a trooper stopped me. And it was getting dark and my lights were on and he pulled me over and he walked up to the car and it was pouring rain. He was looking in the window. And he wrote license and registration. He says, do you know why I stopped you? And I says, no, sir. He says, do you know your taillight is out? And I says, no, I don't know that. I didn't know that. He said, did you know you went through a stop sign? And I says, no, I didn't know that. And he says, you don't know much, do you? And I said, no, but I'm not standing out in the rain. And that'll get you a ticket every time. But that was a different attitude. Understand that spirituality changes your attitude and changes your understanding of life. You know, in 1954, from a solitary confinement cell in the New York State Penitentiary, I had a dream. I had a dream that by the time I passed away in this life, I would be a wealthy person. Now, in 1963, I was worth $55,000, dead or alive. The first dream, I did not realize that alcohol or the pursuit of alcohol had given me that penitentiary dilemma. The second situation, the bounty on my head, I did not realize it was alcohol and the pursuit of alcohol that had put that bounty on my head. Now in 1967, in the early years of a 40-year prison sentence in Attica State Prison, I was working on this punch press machine for 6 cents a day and never once realizing that alcohol or the pursuit of alcohol had caused me to work for such menial labor. That's 30 cents a week, my friends, to do anything I wanted with. Except, this is before the Attica riots, except at that time, the state held half of your pay, as you might call it. We didn't have a union to argue this. Half of the pay until the day you get out. Then you get the other half. It gives you something to go home with. Well, one of the big beefs after the riot in Attica was that some guys were never going home, and they wanted to know what was going to happen to their money and who was getting the interest off it. You know, we had some intellectuals in there, too. Talk about intellectuals. I transferred down to Auburn Prison. I stood out in the yard one December or February. I can't remember. You know, that yard causes a whirlpool, and the wind and the snow was blustering. And I looked around me. We didn't have phone calls in them days. We didn't have TVs in the cellar in the building. But in the corner of the yard, they had a TV up by the wall. And the guys would be out there watching the football game because, you know, they'd be betting cigarettes on it. And you'd see them standing out there with snow, with blankets on their shoulders and snow on their shoulders and snow on their heads and thermos bottles. And then I look around and I see these other guys sitting at a table. You know, they get tables in the yard, playing pinochle or playing whatever, and using weights to hold the cards down so the wind don't blow them out over the yard. And you look over this way, and there's a group of guys playing handball, banging that handball against the wall and slipping on the ice and snow. And over here's a basketball court. They're dribbling and shooting in a damn snowstorm. And that's one of the awakenings that I had. I began to realize, Jimmy, you're not in a prison. You're in a damn nut house. And I'm one of the nuts, because I'm in here. Because I was jogging, keeping in shape. Shape for why? Where are you going? From 1964 to 2004. That's what they told me when I first went up there in Attica. They called me into the service unit. And this guy says, well, you get my yellow sheet out, you know. And the yellow sheet means everything that they thought you did, that you ever got accused of, that you ever got tried for, indicted for, whatever. And I had a pretty long sheet, you know. And I asked him not to flip it over. But he said, according to this yellow sheet, Jimmy, he says, you're going to be with us for quite a while. And see, my sentence began in 1964. And I says, quite a while? I says, what's that? And he says, well, from 1964 to August of 2004. I says, what? He says, from 1964 to August of 2004. That's your maximum expiration date. And I said, oh, I thought you said September. And you know, this, but believe me, this was the attitude I had. This is how we do time. And this is important because I took a lot of this into this room, into this new life. We do time in a sense. I don't care, in a sense, accept the fact, you know, that I got 40 years and I got the appeal going, I got this going, I got, you know, I turned my life and will over to care of God. But I didn't sit in that damn cell thinking about my wife on the outside or the fact that I couldn't do this and couldn't do that. That's doing hard times, see. And I learned to do day at a time in that joint. I learned to start doing a day at a time. A day at a time was being to understand the fact that I'm in here, make the best of it while you're here. And this is what I had to do and this is what I did. So I learned a lot about that in the state prison. I also remember that, you know, I was in... Well, let me just run through it briefly so you won't even think I had a drink. I'll go so fast. In fact, I never did drink when I was in high school. I didn't like school, but so I had to go to something else. I loved sports, but I was never what they call what do they call it, when your mark's got to be so much in order to qualify or something. They never let me suit up. But this kid's too dumb. So I started boxing, and I won the New York State Golden Glove when I was still in high school up there. And I said, wow, this is pretty good. You know, I could fight. I won the light heavyweight title, and then after that, I campaigned around central, northern New York, Pennsylvania, Canada, and I was headlining most of the shows, and I was quite a comer. The people thought I was going to be all right. And I liked it because I didn't have to go to school, and I didn't have to go to work. And getting up at 6 in the morning and running and doing sit-ups and eating and going into the gym and whacking away at somebody while they're whacking away at you. And it'll be work, I said. You know, so maybe the guy was right. I was dumb. But anyway, and after a while I turned pro. But just before I turned professional, I started drinking a little, and it got into my system. And I didn't realize. The first time I drank, I had about 7 beers. And the next morning, I felt so light and fast and speedy, like a Giselle. And I said, wow, I'm going to incorporate this in my training. But not understanding that it wasn't that I wanted to, it was that I had to, because I was alcoholic. I drank once, and my system craved it. It got so I was spending more time in the bars and the saloons than I was in the gymnasium around road work. And I began to lose into people that I really knew I could beat. And that's an awful feeling. And then the promoters kind of backed off. I got involved with the underworld figures. And I'm talking about not hubcap thieves. I'm talking about OC, as they had on my record, organized crime. I was Irish and they're Italian, but that was a big asset to them. Sometimes they worked with me in some things, and sometimes I worked with them. And I've become the big man in the underworld up there, you know? Silk shirts and suits and wide-brim hats. And I mean, this was the 50s and 60s, and I was going strong. And anyway, I had, just briefly, you know, I had a safe conviction. That's when you take money out of the safe, don't belong to you. Across the highway from the state police barracks, they were very offended, and I got 5 years probation, and I was, after only about a year or two, I got involved in what they call a jewelry store heist, and I got a no bill. They mean not enough evidence to indict, but what they did was violate my probation. They only gave me a year. When I come out, I was free from the other, and I thought that was a victory. And on my way back into Syracuse, it was a hot day in September, and I had a couple beers. I thought I would take only one beer. I mean, I thought I would take a case of beer, at least, to get me drunk, because I hadn't had none in so long. But I only had one beer before it was half gone. I had that familiar buzz on. You see the progressiveness that works inside of us, the progressiveness of alcoholism. You know what I'm doing? In a little bit of telling my story, I'm also telling the things I now identify my alcoholism with. And I wish a lot of other people would do that in their story. These things happened to me. I began to do a day at a time in Auburn prison. I began to understand the progressiveness of alcoholism before I even heard about AA. But in 1961, I got married, and I had to take off on my honeymoon on the lam. You see, the grand jury was sitting on some flim-flam scores, or confidence scores, they called it. And I went to Baltimore, Maryland, and, you know, nobody likes to think they're exclusive, but I wonder how many other guys in this room here got extradited on their honeymoon from Baltimore, Maryland, back to New York. And it don't make for a good marriage, you know? But I always told Sal. No, I always told Sal. I wasn't 9 to 5. She knew that. I don't file taxes, you know, I can say it, I didn't. And this is reaping the rewards of that way of thinking. Anyway, I went to trial and I got acquitted, and this made me even a bigger figure. And in 1964 alone, I got indicted in Chautauqua County, down below Buffalo, New York, on 9 counts of forgery. And see, I never once related alcoholism or the pursuit of alcohol to any of this. The reason I wasn't boxing now was because I knew I couldn't make that commitment every day. It was the booze that was keeping me from it. I didn't understand that. In 64, I got indicted on 9 counts of forgery, and the state's attorney says, this guy ain't writing checks or passing them, but he's heading a statewide forgery ring. It's netting quite a few $1,000 a week. We got to put a stop to it. In 1964, again, in Onondaga County in Syracuse, I got indicted on 54 counts of forgery. In 1964, in Onondaga County, I got indicted again on accessory to robbery 1. Each time I went back out on bail, never once realizing it was alcohol, the pursuit of alcohol. You know, in 1964, I got indicted in robbery in the first degree. Now the bonding company was going to think I was becoming a risk. they kind of backed off and lodged me into the new public safety building. And in the summer of 1964, I got indicted by the federal government, the U.S. government, on a $450,000 postal money order scheme with the infamous Utica mob. And this was it, you know, no bail, no nothing. While I'm in the county jail, I was really a good guy. I like people. I love people. And even on that yellow sheet, I told that guy when he was reading me that yellow on that yellow sheet, all them things that I thought I had done wrong. I said, well, what about Mrs. O'Brien? And he says, what about her? And I said, well, there's a nice little lady. I said, you know, I told him I used to take the kids to the movies and pick them up after the movies and take them for ice cream. And that wasn't on the yellow sheet. And Mrs. O'Brien, we went up there. She knew we were hoods, and we used to go up there once in a while and give her some money. She always had a big pot of soup on for us when she knew we were cool. Yeah, just a lovely old lady. And, she lived out in the woods in a little cabin out there before the landlord rent tenant laws, and they could throw you out in a hot second. And she was crying. She didn't have the money for the rent. She had to have it Thursday. I says, when's he come? She says, Thursday. When? Oh, it'll be about 6 o'clock Thursday. So I said, how much is your rent? She told me. So we gave her the rent and a few extra dollars. So Thursday, this guy comes and picks up his rent, see? And about a half mile down the road, he got robbed. And now I told the guy, then on the yellow sheet, and he says, you can't put... I said, well, look. I said, she paid her rent, the landlord got his money, and I got my investment back, and I thought it was good business all around. But he said, Jimmy, somewhere in there, there's a loser. And I think it was the landlord. But who knows? But they didn't put nothing good like that down. So now I'm in the county jail, and I'm buying cigarettes for guys that don't have them, and I'm helping write letters to those that can't express themselves. Letters to their families and their children and their lawyers. And you know, I'm not that brilliant. I'm a high school dropout, but I caught on quick to this. You know, if a guy's going to play football, you got to learn about football. If you're going to be a doctor, you learn about medicine. You live the life I do, you had to know the rules. You had to know, you know, how to make a quick rip. It was important. But a lot of guys didn't. But anyway, I went to trial on the robbery one, and I had the safe conviction. In New York State, as a second offender, I stood to get the maximum of 60 years. And we went to trial, and, you know, I learned to understand juries. I take this handkerchief out to demonstrate. And if you could see the O.J. jury when they come back, you would read it probably a little bit like I would. If the men don't look at the defendant, they look at the ground or they look at the ceiling. And the women come out, for some reason, dabbing their eyes. You know, like they're so sorry they had to make this decision. And your lawyer leans over and says, we're dead. I looked at him and I thought of the big 60 years. I says, what do you mean we, Frank? Me? I'm dead. Another lesson learned. I got to pay for my own mistakes. You learn that in boxing, my friends. If you make a mistake, you pay for it. The corner don't pay for it, you do. So this was important to me. Here is the key to what I'm talking about. The alcoholic mind, the sober mind. The lower self and the upper self. This is so important, my friends. In that county jail, I was in there 14 months. And everybody loved me. I didn't do it for love or nothing. I just did it out of compassion. I saw these poor guys that were hurting, that were charged with these vicious murders and whatever, but if they needed a cigarette, I'd see that they got it. I wasn't plotting or scheming. It went out on percentage. You see, I was supposed to get every year the 60. The judge already said I was a one-man crime wave. He already knew I had 3 indictments from the state and 1 from the federal government that were still awaiting me. Give them 60 and get them out of here. But you know what? Somehow, some way, that judge looked down at me and he only sentenced me to 40 years. Boy, I felt great. I had changed my thinking in the county jail. You see, what the mind gives out, it's like a magnet. Doesn't it make common sense that if I think poor, poor things will happen? If I think good, good things will happen? The spiritual law, spiritual progress we're talking about, the spiritual law of like begets like, it can't be overcome. Who thought that handkerchief wouldn't drop? Watch it. Sorry. Watch it. 3 times. I could do this all night. You try at home. It'll keep falling. the law of gravity. Whoever thought it wouldn't? Whoever would think of overcoming it? Whoever thought it would stay in the air or go that way? If it did, hey, Jimmy's a magician. Jimmy's a genius. Right? I'd be on all the talk shows. Well, the ones that paid the most. Well, let me tell you something. It goes down every time. There it goes again. If a farmer planted corn and grew cotton, wow! The guy plants corn and grows cotton. Another farmer plants radishes and he grows beets. Like would not beget like. The harvest would not be of the seed, and the whole world would be in turmoil. We'd all be wacky. I'd drop something and it'd go up. Somebody would throw something up and it would go down. A farmer would say, I need some corn, and he'd get cabbage. He didn't know why. I say it in a ridiculous manner almost, so we can embed it in our minds. If I think poor, the harvest is of the seed of thought. If I think poor, poor things will happen. If I think negatively, negative things will happen in my life. If I think good, good things will eventually start to happen. If I think better, better things will start to happen. Now, if I told you I'm a high school dropout, I am. But I was never so dumb to know that 2 and 2 was 5, or 2 and 2 wasn't 4. Put it that way. If I stood here right now, before all of you, and Matt tried to make you believe, and you understood this guy really believes 2 and 2 is 5, you'd say there's something wrong with this guy. Because 2 and 2 is 4, and always will be 4. You drop the handkerchief, it'll go down, it always will go down. You plant the seed of corn, and the seed of corn will grow. You plant the seed of cotton, and the seed of cotton will grow. Then what makes us think that a negative approach to a negative situation will give us a positive result? I used to think that. That's about as dumb as thinking 2 and 2 is 4. When I have a negative situation in my life, how I think about that situation is my mental treatment of it. My mental treatment. If I had a slash in my arm and somebody rubbed dirt and sour stuff in there, I don't get infected. And somebody said, Jimmy, don't put that in there. It's going to get worse. And when I have a negative situation, that's the same thing. Treating it wrongly. Treating it poorly. This, my friends, I'm speaking tonight, and maybe no one, someone hasn't understood yet. What's this guy talking? I'm talking sobriety. Because to me, and it may not be the same to any of you, sobriety to me is not drinking a day at a time. Not drinking a day at a time. Not drinking a day at a time is not sobriety. It's not drinking a day at a time. We've seen them. I was there 5 months, raving maniac, and hadn't drank in 5 months, and came to meetings too. Sobriety is not drinking a day at a time in absence of inner turmoil, in absence of all this nonsense going on inside us. And the only way I can rid myself of it, and the only way I can start feeling good about myself and my sobriety is through spiritual progress that the big book asks me to do. Spiritual progress. No other way. There's no other way. Human mind gets happy when they gets a nice car. Guy gets a nice car. He plays golf. He's happy. He meets a new friend. He's happy. But all of a sudden, some sucker comes by and scratches the hell out of that car, and the insurance goes up, and he's limited happiness. He goes out on the golf course with the people he works with, and he wants to impress them. He shoots a lousy game and ends up throwing his club up in the tree. Limited happiness, you see. Limited. The moods start to set in. He has a very good relationship with his friend until the friend starts acting like he wants him or her too. It becomes a strained relationship. Happiness. The human mind has limited happiness. The spiritual mind has eternal joy, inner peace. Right now, at this very moment, I have inside me a pilot light. Nobody can see it, but I can feel it. It's a warm glow. It's a warm glow. And no matter what happens outside me, no matter how negatively or wrong it might be, that pirate light still has that warm glow inside me. This is a wonderful feeling. This is powerful. This is unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. And I can only get that way through spiritual progress. I wasn't always that way. I wasn't always that way the morning they took me up to Attica. You know, in New York State, we have blizzards and we have snowstorms and then we have unbelievables. And we had just had one. And they had to cut the snowplows had to cut a way through the highway to get me up there. And the way they do way up in the northern part of the country where Attica is, up in the Siberia of America almost, is they have the plows that push it back, and even then they have rotors on top of these plows that kick it back another level. And they're taking me up there real early in the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock. And I had leg irons on, and I had a wide leather belt and handcuffs on both sides. And I had state police in front of me and state police behind me, and I was riding with correction officers. And, you know, I was a bad dude in their eyes. And I guess I was in God's eyes, too, at that time. And, you know, even though he loved me. And they took me on up there. And I remember we got up there. It was still early in the morning. It was dark and wet. And they let me out of that car in front of the prison. And I stepped out into that cold, crunchy snow. And I looked around me, you know. I looked up at the tower. And I looked up at the sky first. And I saw those dark, gray, dismal clouds bulging with precipitation. And I looked at that 40-foot wall, and I saw that ice and snow trickling down that dismal gray wall. And I looked up in the tower, and I could see them guards up there with their riot guns or whatever they had looking right down at me. And I looked at the state police and the correction officers with their riot guns. And I looked at myself, and then I said to myself, well, Jimmy, here you are for 40 years, for however long they want to keep you. In New York State, they do their best to keep you, like for 40 years. They told me I had to do 13 years and 9 months before I would even see the parole board. And then I had these other indictments waiting for me. Huh. I had nothing to cheer about. My wife had divorced me. I said, Sal, can't you wait? It's only 40 years. All right, Jimmy, I'm going to move on. But you know what? I never held it against her. I knew that. She had my little baby. She had a life to me. I had to go from that prison, whenever they let me out, into handcuffs and go somewhere else. I knew that. I changed. First miracle of changing my thinking. That's the message I'm trying to give tonight. The first miracle of changing my thinking. Changing my thinking. The miracles happen. I didn't know I was starting to think spiritual. I was trying to. I didn't have to know how it worked. I'm not an electrician, but I'll go over and turn that switch and the lights will go off. And I'll turn it again and the lights will go on. I don't know how that works. I'm not an electrician. If I change my thinking for the good, my life will get better. It has to. It's the cosmic law. It's still falling. It's the cosmic law. Now, I also know that when I go to parole, I've already beat him out of, well, I'm still a dropout. From 8-4 to 13-9, that's how much, you know, I was awarded by changing my own thinking. And I knew when I went to parole, they'd say, well, you know, you already got a break on the modifying the sentence and all these other indictments and whatever. They weren't going to let me go. They said, give us 2 more years. They told me to go home. Miracle number 2 of just changing my thinking. Miracle number 2. Now, on the day that I was supposed to leave the prison, so I'm really not going nowhere. The state's got 3 indictments. The feds have got 1. Where am I going? But when I got out in front of that prison, my brother-in-law and a friend of mine, Joey, who owned a bar, they were there, and nobody else. I said, come on, let's get out of here. And we did. My friends, that was in 1973. And I say it loud now. I used to whisper. To this day, I have never heard a word about any of them indictments. You see how my God works in my life. My problems that I think I have, as long as I'm going toward God and sobriety and spirituality, they dissolve. They evaporate. cast your burdens upon me. Let go and let God. In other words, give it to God and don't figure what he's going to do with it. Just expect it to happen, and it does. I came into AA, I told you, over 30-some years on parole. Do you want to know something? After about a year or so, they called me up parole and says, Jimmy, they modified the parole law. You see, God knows my heart. He knows I'm sincere. Give us 5 good years. It's not mandatory, but you can get off parole. Well, I didn't try to give them 5 good years. I just practiced the steps in this program in my life. And after 5 years, they cut me loose. I don't owe no parole, no 2004, no nothing. I'm as free as anyone in this room, and excuse me for saying this, but probably freer than most. Because I began to realize, my friends, that my enemies were of my own household. Not my sisters, brothers, cousins. My enemies are of my own household. My enemies are my thoughts. My household is my mind. And all I had to do was clear my mind. Clean it out once and keep it cleaned out. You see, someone asked me several times, Jimmy, how about anger and resentment? I mean, if somebody wronged you, it's natural. It's natural to get upset. It's natural to get mad. I used to think the same thing. I really did. Until I began to understand that I was created in my God's image. It's natural. My God said, I created the world and all is good. It's natural. If I'm in his image, it's only natural for me to be loving and to be good. Not to be angry, resentful, pitiful, guilty, sour, sick, sad. That's how far man has fallen from God and from himself. That's unnatural. If it was natural, you'd feel good about it. You'd feel great. Nobody would come to a meeting and say, I was so angry that I almost drank today. The big book itself wouldn't say that resentment is the greatest killer of alcoholics. They'd say, resentment, that's good. You don't have enough of it, get some more. Go to an AA meeting, and I'm not criticizing, I was there. What I'm trying to do is maybe enlighten to what helped me. I have analogies and parables, and whether they're true or not, I say them so much I don't even remember. But two bums were sitting on a park bench, and we know what bums were in our day, you know, it was guys like us. And they're down to their last cigar butt, and they're passing around, and they have nothing, nowhere to sleep or nothing. And one guy says, you know, they got a meeting down the street here, they call it Prosperity Anonymous. I go, what's that? Well, prosperity means, you know, you start making money, you start living better. I said, well, let's go. So they go down there. Now, there's no such meeting yet, I don't think. Unless Manny Shevitz is going to start one. They go into the meeting, they sit in the back. And the chairman of Prosperity Anonymous, see, these people were all broke at one time themselves, went real bad, and now they're recovering. They're recovering. You know, they're paying their bills, and they got money in their pocket, and they're driving cars, and they're doing pretty well. And the chairman says, has anybody got a topic? And one of the two bums in the back says, yeah, I want to hear more about poverty. He says, oh, wait a minute. No, we're here to get out of poverty. We're here to get away from it. We want to talk prosperity. You see, my friend, if you keep talking about poverty, you can't get out of it. You can't get away from it. You see, a man that thinks poverty thoughts will stay in poverty. If you talk prosperity and start thinking prosperous thoughts, you can become prosperous. Now you know when you go to an AA room and the chairman says, does anyone have a topic? Yeah, I want to hear more about anger. Well, I'm not ridiculing it because I'll hear it probably at a meeting tomorrow. I'm not, but see what I'm talking about? I want to hear more about resentment. I want to hear about those who keep going back out because I keep going out, one guy said just last week. I want to hear about those people. No, my friends. I want to hear about sobriety. I want to hear about spiritual growth. I don't want to hear more about anger, resentment, pity, guilt. I don't want that in me anymore. You know, it never really was. I began to learn in my spirituality, in my spiritual growth, that all the wonders I ever sought were already inside me. Please believe me when I tell you this. We search outside for happiness. We search outside. A woman comes to me once and says, Jimmy, this might explain what I'm saying. She says, I wish I had your patience. And I says, oh, you do? And she says, yes. She was very calm when she said this to me. And I said to her, I said, you already have. She says, what do you mean? She says, no, I'm a very, I get upset very easy. I said, are you calm and patient right now? And she says, yes. And I says, well, let me ask you, tell you this, that if a God gave you, me, more patience than you, would he be a fair God? And she said, no. And I said, well, you had the same as I do. The problem is in a negative situation, you surrender it to take on a negative attitude, and I don't. I retain mine. How do you retain it? How do I retain it? How do I refrain, put it this way, from anger, resentment, those emotions that could lead me to a drink that I used to think were so natural to have? Simply like this. At one time, the most powerful compulsion I ever had on a daily basis was to drink alcohol. So powerful. It sent me to prison for 40 years. So powerful that my wife divorced me. So powerful I gave up an athletic career. So powerful that I was down and out many a time and still drank. What greater compulsion I ever had to overcome, I don't know. It was the obsession to drink on a daily basis. And even when I came in here and put the drink down a day at a time, never did I realize I would enjoy a day without a drink. I might be able to do it, man, but I ain't going to enjoy it. Today, the thought of a drink has no attraction. The thought of a drink has no value. The thought of a drink is an ugly thought. It's no longer a pleasant thought. Now, if with my cooperation, which means became willing, that's what it means, God knows my heart, he can remove that obsession from me, what's the problem with anger, resentment, guilt, pity? All I had to do was take the value off those emotions. They are negative, they are non-productive, they do nothing for me, but give me high blood pressure maybe, a fast beating heart, and an ugly outer as well as an ugly inner. Take the value off it. Look God and love into everything. Look sobriety into everything. It's unbelievably great. You know, I don't have much time left, and I'm just getting started. And I look at Rachel with that red and white striped shirt on, and I say, boy, she looks better in stripes than I did. Same as this young lady over here. But you know, as I talk, I look around, and these are the thoughts, you know, and I think they're going to celebrate 9 months tonight for that beautiful little girl over there with the long brown hair and the beautiful complexion and the pleasing smile, and that's Ginger. And you know, just knowing she's getting 9 months, it just fills me up inside. And there's 1, 2, 3, about 6 rowdies from Woodstock over there that come to see me or to hear me. You know, that means so much. And if they get out of hand, I'll be responsible. Billy's their leader, you know, but they listen to Manny Shevitz too. But this is the program. It isn't being sitting on your hands. I understand when I first came in. I understand all this. But there's a time to break free. There's a time to want to become new and better and loving. There's time to want to pass it on to others and see them grow in their life and their sobriety too. And you know, I'll close with something probably you've heard before, you know. Simply this, that I may not ever be the man I want to be. I may never be the man I ought to be. But I thank my God, you people in this program, I'm not the man I used to be. Thank you.